Listen, Bill, I don't think you realize what kind of trouble you were in last night.
Who do you think those people were? Those were not just ordinary people there. If I told you their names, I'm not going to tell you their names, but if I did, I don't think you'd sleep so well.
Stay tuned for Playboy's Pajama Party with the Village People and a preview of the Playmates of the 80s.
Here we are. You got me into your house. You give me a drink. You put on music. Now you start opening up your personal life to me and tell me your husband won't be home for hours.
So?
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me. Aren't you?
I think that that legally and culturally that our society and much of the Western world, and apparently at least to the same degree the eastern part of the world as well, is still suffering from really deep-seated sexual repression, and we are still a long ways from throwing off the chains of sexual superstition and bondage.
St. Augustine said a man has as many masters as he has vices. The picture of Samson and Delilah on the cover of my book is basically the story of a man who was enslaved by his passions and ended up being blind. Mm-hmm. That's the whole rationale behind the weaponization of pornography. Make you blind, and then you're easier to push around.
Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have John Friend back on the show. Of course, John is a columnist for the American Free Press and the host of the Realist Report and the AFP Report podcast, both carried by the American Free Press, correct?
Well, you know what? The Realist Report is actually my own personal website that I've had for a number of years now.
Okay, that's independent. Okay.
Yeah, it's sort of independent. I mean, I often will interview people connected to the newspaper or to the Barnes Review History Magazine, which I also write for and help edit. So basically all three of those podcasts are sort of connected with not only my website, but also American Free Press and the Barnes Review. And you can find all of the podcasts that I do right on my website. Any podcast that I do for American Free Press or for the Barnes Review, I also post on my website as well, which is therealistreport.com. And like I said, I've been maintaining that website for, almost 10 years now, I think. So I'm getting old, Tim. It's crazy how long I've been involved in this.
Well, you're getting old just a symptom of living, if I understand. So
yes, absolutely.
So only one way to stop it. There's only one cure for it. So now, okay. Well, you recently conducted an interview with John Whitehead, the lawyer in Virginia who specializes in civil liberties and government abuse. He's always on the lookout for authoritarian government, and he's written a lot about this material. He's engaged in a lot of activism, legal activism, providing legal services to people who are victims of the state. But he recently penned an article, "Evil Walks Among Us: Child Trafficking Has Become Big Business in America," and you interviewed him about this. I read the article. The numbers that he cites were disturbing and astonishing, but most people aren't aware of the magnitude of this problem in the United States and around the world. And so you interviewed him, you read the article, I read the article. I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah, no, John Whitehead, he runs the, I think it's called the Rutherford Institute.
Yes.
Yeah, it's rutherford.org is the website. And I've been following his work for a number of years. His commentaries are often featured in the pages of American Free Press. And yeah, he's got a lot of really interesting things to say, and he writes about a lot of important topics. Although I do have to say up front, some of the things he said in that interview I don't totally endorse or agree with. But then again, you're probably never going to talk to somebody that you agree with on everything or agree with their perspective on everything. But that being said, yeah, this article was very, very important. It's a very, very ugly topic. I mean, it's one that is very difficult for me anymore to even contemplate and think about. I mean, there's just some horrific stories that have come out recently, including one I wanted to briefly mention. I don't know if you saw that town hall investigation into that gay couple in Atlanta.
I'm aware of it.
But yeah, anyways, we can get to that in just a few minutes. But there's, you know, these stories, you know, they come out. If you follow like local news, you'll often see them reported, but they don't really ever make national media attention. So it's not really something that's on anybody's radar. But John Whitehead's article, and this article was actually published at the end of January. You can find it over on Rutherford.org or in the pages of American Free Press. It was published in, I think, the last issue, if I'm not mistaken. But anyways, the article definitely shed some major light on this issue and just the reality that child sex trafficking, which is, I mean, really just an unfathomable subject for most average people, it is extremely prevalent and people just don't realize it. In the piece, which is, I think, definitely worth reading for all the details, but Whitehead talks about how many children that get caught up in this are often as young as 7 or 8 years old. And now with social media, you know, predators are preying on them very easily, you know, monitoring their social media feeds and getting in touch with them that way. So obviously, I think the big lesson here is parents need to be aware of what their kids are looking at and doing on the internet, certainly in this modern culture. But in many cases, as he points out in the article, parents are actually involved in the sexual abuse, or sometimes it's law enforcement. He cites many examples in the article of cops raping or sexually abusing citizens. And some of these law enforcement officers, you know, once this is discovered, it turns out that they have a very long history of engaging in this sort of behavior. And another thing he points out is that foster homes and youth shelters have become prime targets for sexual predators. And this is something that we saw certainly with the whole Franklin scandal. That was really kind of what woke me up to this disgusting topic years ago when I first looked into it. But I mean, vulnerable children, even those who come from stable to, you know, parent households, get caught up in this mess if they are not careful and if they don't have good, solid parental guidance and direction and discipline. So yeah, it's a really, really ugly topic. If you don't mind, do you mind if I just like briefly read the intro to the article? It kind of, you know, give some interesting stats and figures just to kind of give people an idea of what we're talking about here.
No, go right ahead.
Yeah, so he starts off, he quotes a guy named John Ryan from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And he says, children are being targeted and sold for sex in America every single day. And then he begins the column by saying, it takes a special kind of evil to prostitute and traffic a child for sex, and yet this evil walks among us every minute of every day. Consider this, every 2 minutes, a child is bought and sold for sex. Hundreds of young girls and boys, some as young as 9 years old, are being bought and sold for sex as many as 20 times per day. Adults purchase children for sex at least 2.5 million times a year in the United States alone. In Georgia alone, it is estimated that 7,200 men, half of them in their 30s, seek to purchase sex with adolescent girls each month, averaging roughly 300 a day. On average, a child might be raped by 6,000 men during a 5-year period. It is estimated that at least 100,000 to 500,000 children, girls and boys, are bought and sold for sex in the U.S. every year, with as many as 300,000 children in danger of being trafficked each year. Some of these children are forcefully abducted, others are runaways, and still others are sold into the system by relatives and acquaintances. Basically, child rape has become big business in America, and it's a problem found not only in America's big cities, but in virtually every community in the country. And throughout this article, I mean, he must have, geez, I don't even know, 50 or 60 links to other sources, you know, documenting all of this. So he's making a lot of, you know, pretty bombshell claims, in my opinion, but they're all backed up by, you know, legitimate news stories and stuff. So it's a huge problem. It's one that doesn't get a lot of coverage. I was sort of surprised to see this. I don't know if he's covered this issue too closely in the past, but this article definitely stood out to me, and I thought it was very, very important, and I'm glad that we were able to publish it in the newspaper. And yeah, it's just it's horrific, and this is something that, again, most people simply don't know about. I mean, I mentioned that town hall investigative report on the gay couple in Atlanta. I think they were like in their late 20s or early 30s, two men who adopted two boys through a Christian special needs adoption agency. And they ended up raping them. They were literally pimping their adopted sons out to other pedophiles. And apparently they also made homemade pornography videos of this sexual abuse and may have been distributing that. I'm not sure exactly all of the details. I know the article, you could find it. Anybody's interested could find it just by Googling town hall and you know, homosexual couple, something like that. And it should come right up. But this barely got any coverage at all. I mean, I think I saw it reported in like the New York Post and I think the Daily Mail over in the UK as well. But those publications are sort of mainstream publications that will actually report on stuff like this. I mean, I don't remember seeing this on Fox News or CNN. I could be wrong, but it definitely didn't get the coverage that it deserves. I mean, this is a horrific story. The fact that something like this could happen in our country and, you know, people are not literally being like strung up is just outrageous. It shows, you know, how far we have fallen as a nation.
Yeah, like the adoptive services don't have the discernment or the good judgment to say, no, two homosexual men aren't suitable figures to pretend they're parents for two kids in need of adoption. And I remember this about 20 years ago, people saying, well, I know you may feel this way about homosexuality, but isn't it better for a kid to be adopted by somebody, than to be left in foster care or left unadopted, than to give them, you might as well just give them to two homosexual people or men who are going to care for the child. I said, no, you have to question their motives in these things. And also, whenever you're deciding who to give, who to grant adoption to, you're going to assess their character and their behavior. The problem is that as a society, we no longer, publicly, we can no longer publicly criticize homosexuality as immoral or a sign of lack of character or emotional psychological instability. So now these institutions like adoptive services and foster care are going to be infiltrated the same way the Boy Scouts were once you grant them access. There was a time when society just said, no, this isn't proper. Two homosexual men have no business trying to adopt children. They're not suitable, parental figures. It's not a suitable environment. But now,
absolutely.
We look at Pete Buttigieg, our Secretary of Transportation. I think they adopted him and his male lover adopted two, I think, twins too.
Didn't I mean?
And it's human trafficking, by the way.
They
bought what they did was they paid a woman to conceive a child.
Yeah. Okay. Exactly.
I think it was twins. I might be mistaken. But.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think they did actually pay a woman to like birth their quote unquote child.
It's child trafficking.
It is. It's you know what it is. It's a total degradation and just a total affront to the concept of parenthood. You know, to the concept of raising a family. I mean, it's just a disgrace. It's an outrage, and it totally reflects on just how far we have fallen as a
family.
Nation.
Family comes in all shapes and sizes, right?
Yeah. There's no stigmas associated with these behaviors anymore. It's a free for all. It really is like a total satanic takeover of our country where anything goes and, you know, it's just free will and do what thou pleases and these sorts of concepts. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely disgusting. And there are horrific stories like this on a daily basis. But, you know, as I mentioned, I mean, there's very few who don't already follow the topic. You know, very few people know about this. I mean, unless you're already aware of this issue and sort of, you know, following it actively, you know, it just simply does not receive major mass media attention or coverage, at least for the most part. And again, that says a lot about our mass media complex in this country itself. It is totally compromised and in some cases may even be involved with this type of disgusting behavior. I mean, certainly the way it's, you know, sort of celebrating like the Buttigieg situation or other examples like that. I mean, it's elevating that sort of behavior and glorifying it and making it, quote unquote, the new normal. And, you know, that's just to me totally unacceptable. And I think to most Christians and to most average decent people in this country.
Yeah, we've had a few cases where the CNN had an executive producer that was caught engaging in pedophilia, and he was, I think, obviously he resigned, was fired, and he was convicted. But if that's the type of people who are running the media, and they're not going to,
right?
Yeah, they're going to spin it in a way that's most favorable to, sort of characterize the issue that favors, their interest and their perceived interest and how they want to, what agendas they have to promote.
Absolutely.
But
I was going to
go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was going to say this, the sheer magnitude that John Whitehead cites here suggests that there's been a sort of an alchemical debasement of society where this isn't just a problem that's always been there. Obviously, we know stories from the Bible, Sodom and Gomorrah, and these things have occurred since time immemorial. But America has gone through a fundamental change in the past 50, 60 years in its public morality and its sensibilities, to the point where public institutions no longer can practice. In fact, they're told not to practice good judgment for the interest of children, like this adoptive services where they literally just deliver these two kids in the hands of these predators, not even thinking twice about it, apparently. And this is fairly common, and because you don't want to discriminate against someone. In fact, you want to promote it because it's something you should be proud about, according
right.
To the calendar.
Yeah, that's just what I was going to say. It's they're not only doing this, but they're actively like glorifying it and elevating it as if it's a moral right or something. It's totally outrageous. And I also wanted to mention, I know we talked about this before we started recording, my intro into this topic was actually discovering John DeCamp's book, The Franklin Cover-Up.
Mm-hmm.
The full title is The Franklin Cover-Up, Child Abuse, Satanism, and Murder in Nebraska. I'm sure you're familiar with this case.
Oh, yeah. That's back in the – it took place 80s and 90s. Yeah.
Well, yeah, exactly. So and you know, it's interesting because I actually grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, and I never heard of this when I was a kid. I was born in 1986. And the Franklin Community, I think it was called the Franklin Community Federal Credit Union,
mm-hmm.
which is sort of what, initiated this whole investigation into what was going on. This credit union was raided and shut down by the feds, I think it was late, like October, November, December, 1988, I think it was.
Yeah, like they lost like $40 million or something. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's a huge amount of money missing from their books. And the credit union was actually headed by a leading GOP operative, a black man named Larry King, who was also deeply connected with many elites in the Omaha area and, of course, in Washington, D.C. And I remember discovering a book, as I mentioned, The Franklin Cover-Up, Child Abuse, Satanism, and Murder in Nebraska, written by John DeCamp, who was a state senator who helped investigate this case after the credit union got shut down. And, it ended up unraveling into this massive, massive scandal. And they started investigating the corruption at the credit union and ended up discovering like this very elaborate nationwide, maybe even worldwide, child trafficking ring with many very credible allegations of satanic ritual abuse and child rape and trafficking, sexual blackmail, drug running even. And there were even claims of ritual murder, which was something that like just – I had like nightmares reading this book. I vividly remember this. I had like just graduated college and had no idea about this. I don't think most people in Omaha would know about this, at least most people that I know. And it's simply just unfathomable that this was happening right here in my hometown.
Wasn't there a legislative investigation into this thing?
He
was a state senator, right? Yeah.
So. Yeah, exactly. DeCamp was actually involved in the state Senate investigation, and they were met with very stiff resistance by local officials, by local law enforcement, by the FBI, by federal officials. And even by like the local newspaper, the Omaha World Herald, there's a lot of detail in the book about that situation.
Yeah, one of the editors was implicated in the ring, actually.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, exactly. And it's a pretty, long sort of elaborate story. I can't recall like every single detail, but there was a lot of very credible allegations made, and a lot of the victims that were coming out and speaking out about this ended up suffering or dying or ended up getting locked up themselves. I mean, some of them were found guilty. I think there was at least one or two of them that were found guilty of perjury. And the judge basically said that they made everything up, you know? And the whole situation was just so evil and sinister. It was like something out of a movie almost. And one of the lead individuals, and I cannot recall his name. I'll see if I can look it up quickly. But one of the lead investigators that worked with DeCamp was actually killed in a very mysterious plane accident.
Oh, yeah, Gary Caradore.
Yeah, okay, was that his name? Oh, you have a better memory than me, yeah.
He was an investigator hired by DeCamp, and he was spearheading the investigation on behalf of the legislature, of the Nebraska legislature.
Yeah, exactly,
And his plane blew up, disintegrated in midair, coming back from Chicago from the All-Star Game in 1989. He's with his kid. It's very tragic.
Imagine that, the plane mysteriously blowing up, you know? It's a lot of coincidences there. So, yeah, this was really kind of my wake-up call into all this, and that led down all sorts of other avenues. I had, like, kind of recently discovered 9/11 Truth, and so I was already, like, blown away by that. And then all of a sudden I discover this book, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, there's even more to learn about. Like,
so you're suffering all types of psychological trauma.
Oh, my gosh, yeah, to say the least. And it all, you know, it all sort of came at me at once, and it was like, oh, my gosh, I got to learn about everything now. So, you know, actually, I was before we started, I actually looked up I just Googled Franklin Credit Union, I think. And the Franklin Child Prostitution Ring allegations comes up on Wikipedia. And it's amazing the way they have totally spun this on Wikipedia, which is probably shouldn't surprise anybody. But they describe that the allegations made by the Senate Investigative Committee and a lot of the children that were involved, you know, that were caught up in this. They were unfounded allegations, and it was discovered that the ring that they described was a carefully crafted hoax.
Carefully? And oh, wow. Okay.
It was a carefully crafted hoax that all, you know, all these kids that were involved in this and victims of this just, you know, happened to make up or something, apparently they claimed. And this was a grand jury that concluded this officially at the time in 1990.
I wonder what Snopes has to say about it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, they're probably saying the same thing that Wikipedia is saying. But the article, it uses words like baseless allegations, unfounded allegation, you know, typical like we hear with all the disinformation language that we see that's so prevalent in the media today. You know, baseless allegations of electoral fraud in the 2020 election, things like that. It reads like, you know, you could be reading like the New York Times or something. But anyways, this was a very, very credible investigation, and I have no doubt that a lot of the claims that were made were probably true, and these people, and these young kids, suffered all sorts of very evil abuses at the hands of some of the most powerful elites, not only in Nebraska, but this went all the way to the White House.
Yeah, there's a Washington in June 1989. There's a front page article, the Washington Times, about tours of the White House, call boys in the White House, and the Times just stopped covering him suddenly.
Yeah, exactly. Very curious.
Well, I think Paul Rodriguez, who was a good reporter for the Times, he's since passed away, was covering it, and it just stopped. But yeah, there are tours to the White House in the latter 8 years of the Reagan and early days of the Bush administration. Tied to this. This involved what was his name? Craig Spence. Craig Spence?
Okay. Yeah.
He was a GOP lobbyist, whatever, but he was really involved in this ring. This is where the blackmail angle comes in. He would host these parties. He had a large house or mansion in Washington, D.C., where he'd host parties, and reportedly it was wired for audiovisual, I guess operated by some, you know, alphabet super agency, yet unnamed, yet right. Identified. He committed suicide too, eventually.
Now, weren't there a lot of allegations about the young boy Johnny Gosch that disappeared?
Yeah, Johnny Gosch disappeared.
Iowa, and part of that network. Been involved in part of that whole network. Yeah,
and some people have speculated that the late what's his name, Colonel Aquino was involved in that, but I don't know if that's true or not. The Satanist. The head chaplain for the Pentagon. So.
You know, what I discovered researching a lot of this stuff is that a lot of it came from firsthand testimony. And there was and given just the nature of it and then the people involved, that there wasn't a huge amount of documented evidence. But there were a lot of very credible allegations and a lot of dots that were connected at the time by independent researchers. I remember Ted Gunderson. He was a former – he was actually another Nebraska guy, a former FBI – I think he actually headed the FBI in Los Angeles for a
period
of time.
He was. He handled security for the Olympics and there.
And he was majorly involved in a lot of these investigations, including the Franklin cover-up and some, you know, some subsequent investigations into you know, child sex trafficking and things like this. And there have been other whistleblowers. There was a Jewish guy from New York, I think he was a police detective, NYPD. I can't remember exactly. Again, I should have brushed up on this before we started the show, but his name was Rothstein, I want to say.
Oh, yeah. He was actually Catholic.
Was he? Oh,
but his name is Rothstein. I heard him interviewed. He later became a mayor out in the Midwest somewhere. but he held it. That ties as far back as the Son of Sam case. And that also has an angle to it, which isn't quite as simple as the media. You know, the lone nut thinking his dog is telling him to kill people. There was a snuff film ring feeding for elite and all that. And that's covered, Detective Rothstein was brought in to investigate the trafficking of children from the Midwest into New York City.
Okay, right, yeah.
He was a Gold Shield detective, and it was a special department that was created office created within the NYPD. Which is a huge operation, by the way. I think they even have their own intelligence operation. They probably rank up there with the Mossad or something. But yeah, he exposed a lot was going on in New York, where people were being trafficked into New York from the Midwest into New York, and that was his. And he was from the Midwest originally, which is why he knew the people, the type of people who were being targeted by it. That's why he was picked for that position. But he talks about a lot of the Black Marangle, you know, with in New York with what's his name, you know, Roy Cohn.
Oh, okay, right.
And Roy, and how this this
factors deeply connected to Trump, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and the political brat, and you know, from what I understand, Bishop Spellman being compromised, and this is this. Factors into Spellman's support for like things like the Vietnam War.
These leads go deep, and they seem to connect to everybody, at least to a lot of very important people. And it's a huge topic, and I think overall, I mean, just the fact that our elites are engaged in sexual blackmail operations, or at least certain intelligence agencies, certain organized crime networks. For some reason, all of whom happen to be just happen to be Jews as individuals.
Yeah, I think that's how the ADL got control of the FBI by
blackmailing
Hoover way back in the day, back in the late 30s.
Louis
Rosenstiel and Meyer Lansky's operation. These are all gangsters, Jewish gangsters. You know.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a long history of this sort of. You know, sordid behavior and corruption and just outright blackmail of individuals and you know, setting them up with child prostitutes or just prostitutes in general, getting them to engage in some scandalous behavior or even worse than that, and using that as leverage over them to manipulate them politically, to get them on board, to basically to do their bidding. And that's, of course, what the whole Jeffrey Epstein situation was all about. And there's been a lot of information that's come out over the years relating to him. What was it? It was a Trump official. And he basically admitted that he learned that Epstein was connected to intelligence, but he didn't say which intelligence network. This was back when he was tied up with charges in Florida.
Yeah. Alex Acosta.
Like 2008. Acosta. Okay. That's,
he was being vetted for Department of Labor, Secretary of Labor.
Either labor or transportation, I want to say, something like that.
But he was being asked about that during the process because in 2007, there had been that sweetheart deal given to him by another Jewish prosecutor down in Florida, who later was given like a Torches of Freedom Award from the ADL for his efforts. He was being asked and about this deal that was given because he was the U.S. attorney down there, and he was told to back off by somebody. Epstein belonged to intelligence and to back off. Now, who has the authority to tell the U.S. attorney to back off?
Yeah, and this was when he was sort of being probed to come in as, you know, in the Trump administration. And you're right, he was a Secretary of Labor. And what, apparently while he was being like debriefed and you know, they were going through his background and stuff, yeah, he admitted that he was told to back off and to leave Epstein alone, basically, because he, quote, belonged to intelligence.
Now, you know, that was like reported in like in the mainstream press. And when someone, when a reporter gets that, shouldn't the follow-up question would be, what?
Right.
So
connected to intelligence, which intelligence and for what purpose? Right.
Yeah. What's going on here? Oh, intelligence agencies are involved in human trafficking? Wait a second. Like this might be an interest to the public, but no one.
Yeah. And involved in human trafficking, child sex trafficking, blackmail operations. Yeah. I think there's a little bit of public interest there. And yeah, you know, the whole Epstein situation was so bizarre. I mean, it's like if you believe that, I mean, you'll literally believe anything. And sadly, there's probably a lot of Americans that do accept that story at face value. You know, his alleged suicide in the prison or whatever. It's just totally not even plausible in my view.
No, it's like he's put in his awful prison, then the videotape stopped working and incompetent guards and.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, it's like one coincidence after the other. It's just ridiculous. You know, did you read that article, that book review of Whitney Webb's recent book, One Nation Under Blackmail?
Oh, yeah, Jason Cannon's review. It was very good. Yeah.
Yeah, it was very good, very very revealing, and you know, it sort of shows. I mean, I've never interviewed Whitney Webb or. You know, talk to her. I've never had any communication with her, but I've always really liked her work. She's a very, very good journalist, a very dedicated and hardworking journalist that really digs into a lot of very important topics. But you know, reading this book review, and I haven't read the book, but you know, you're left with the conclusion that it's just these darn individuals who just so happen to be extremely Jewish and extremely, you know, connected to the broader international Jewish community, mm-hmm. and the Jewish state of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're very, very ethnocentric, and they care very much about their Jewish identity and what they perceive to be Jewish interests. And it's these quote unquote individuals who are blackmailing our government and involved in this massive international criminal conspiracy. However, you can't read too much into their ethnic identity.
Did I mention that they're all Jewish?
Yeah. You can't read too much into their ethnic identity or their Jewishness, or draw the obvious and very appropriate.
Well, I think what's holding her back, obviously what's inhibiting her there, is she knows what happens to people who cross that line, who make that very impolite observation, you know, at a party. It's just not supposed to do that. It's not what polite people do. It's not fit for polite company to talk about the Jewish question in regards to that issue. She also, from what I gather, comes sort of from the progressive left, and you know, they have certain, I guess, preconceived or sort of prejudices or assumptions in these things. And I get a lot, if you read stuff from like the Last American Vagabond and all that, you know, or, you know, to them, a reference point is the Third Reich and Hitler, right?
Right.
And yep. So, you know, to all of a sudden to be confronted with the Jewish question would force you to reconsider some of these other reference points or you know, foundational ideas you have about, you know, the past 100 years. And so there's that. Then there's also the power structure, meaning that if you were to come out and maybe take on the issue the same way that, say, other people do, you'd suffer their wrath, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'll be the first to admit that absolutely does happen. If you bring up the Jews in polite society, it is probably the most taboo subjects out there. But that being said, if you're a true, honest investigative journalist or reporter or, you know, historian or somebody who's just interested in these topics in general and you want to get to the bottom of things, I mean, how do you not draw the obvious conclusions?
Well, I mean, in her defense, she does name the names and she talks about Israel, Zionists, Mossad, and these Jewish billionaires, the network and all that. But then she doesn't say, you know, it's because of the Jewish people, the Jewish collective that exists, you know. That,
right.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sorry, I'm not even trying to, like, beat up on her or anything like that. I think her work is great. I'm just saying, like, in general, like, it's just one of these taboos that is just so even to people who know about these things and who know about Zionism, they know about the state of Israel, they know about these international criminal Jewish networks that are engaging in blackmail and sexual trafficking. It's just still so difficult to overcome this taboo. And to recognize that, yeah, like the Jews are very, very – like the Jews in general, like the collective, you know, Jewish group. I mean, they are very ethnocentric, probably the most ethnocentric group of people in the world.
Yeah, the groupiest group that ever grouped.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, there's even public opinion polls that will show you that. But, it's like we still explain it away as, you know, they just happen to be individuals who just so happen to be in key positions of power and influence and who just so happen to collaborate with other Jews, with other quote-unquote Jewish individuals, to engage in these massive conspiracies and to commit crime. And, you know, despite the fact that they all donate billions of dollars to the organized Jewish community and attend their local synagogue and give money to Israel and support groups that welcome refugees to America in the West – and support LGBT, you know, Q+ groups and all this other madness we see in the world today, it's like we still can't draw the obvious conclusions and, you know, talk about this like adults. And again, this isn't even necessarily directed at Whitney Webb. I'm just saying as a society in general, no matter how well documented all this is and well put together and well sourced and even, you know, quoting from themselves, even quoting from individuals in the organized Jewish community explaining all of this and explaining what they're about, explaining their agenda, explaining how they're doing all this to advance what they perceive as collective Jewish interests, you know, we still can't just deal with it as adults in America.
Yeah. If you don't make that category, you don't identify the category, it's a categorical error. And if you did, you'd be able to deal with it much more effectively. You could know to be on guard or to exclude from certain positions based on that category. And it's just something that is necessary given the way they behave as a group, their organizations behave. There's in that article that he mentions, Webb interviewed with Maria Farmer, one of Epstein's victims. And he wrote, Webb first came to my attention when she conducted an interview with Maria Farmer, considered the earliest Epstein victim to report him to the authorities. The interview is long, upwards of 3 hours, but well worth the listen, especially when Farmer begins to discuss how she was treated by the powerful Jewish figures surrounding Epstein. Farmer said, I don't know any white supremacists, but I do know a lot of Jewish supremacists. They made it very clear that I was a servant to them because I was white.
Exactly, showing their hostility towards the outgroup, who they've always viewed primarily as white Western Christian peoples, I would say.
And the girls, the girls, particularly the attractive white females, ethnic white females, these are shiksas. It's a Jewish word, and obviously an operation like Epstein and those who partook in it. The list is long, from what I understand, and a lot of very powerful, influential figures on that list. And, you know, it's something that has to be made mention, or it has something that cannot be noticed and should be discussed openly, because it's a categorical reality that we have to accept in order to deal with it, the truth of the matter.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and previously in the review, it's actually the section titled Chapter 9, High Tech Treason. Webb discusses Robert Maxwell, the quote-unquote British media mogul. He's actually a Jew and was one of Israel's probably one of the most notorious, you know, international Jewish spies in the history, you know, at least in modern history. And he, you know, he had major connections to Epstein and, of course, Ghislaine is his daughter. And she has a quote in here about how MI6 – attempted to recruit Maxwell for its service, and it concluded after conducting an extensive background check that Maxwell was a quote Zionist loyal only to Israel. So here's this major media mogul.
I thought he was British.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Well, that's what I'm getting at. I mean, yeah. and you know, I guess it's sort of it's not a black and white thing, but generally speaking, Jews are, in fact, loyal to the Jewish people, and they view Israel as the Jewish state. Israel is described as the Jewish state, and certainly the new Netanyahu government makes no bones about that.
Well, this is a problem when you have Jews working for your intelligence agencies or your Treasury Department. If their loyalty is to the Israeli state and not to their country, and the doctrine of Zionism creates that suspicion, you know. It's like if you have someone in charge of, say, cybersecurity in the United States, and she happens to be Jewish and she's a supporter of Israel and Zionism, what's her ties to Unit 8200?
Yep.
Right.
Exactly.
That's a legitimate. That is a legitimate suspicion you have, but under the liberal doctrine of civic nationalism, you can't have that because those sort of ethnic or primordial loyalties don't exist because we're all Americans if we just have the right ideas. And that, of course, that isn't that simple, particularly when it comes to Jews. There's a good example of this, of course, is the Jonathan Pollard case, the man that Trump pardoned after being paid off by Sheldon or ordered by Sheldon Adelson. He flew back to Israel on Sheldon Adelson's plane, Jonathan Pollard, after being pardoned. Now, he betrayed the United States to the Soviet Union, supposed arch enemy during the Cold War, for the benefit of Israel. And when he is flown back to Israel, he's treated and lands in Tel Aviv, he's treated like a hero. Well, if he betrayed the United States and is a hero to Israel, and is Israel our ally? How does that work? And then he proceeds. They give a speech urging all Jews to spy like him in America, to be a spy for Israel. That's the man that Trump pardoned. And like I said, if the organized Jewish community, obviously Pollard's Jewish ethnicity or identity mattered more than his American citizenship. And therein lies the problem.
Right. And there's been a long running campaign. I mean, prior to Trump pardoning Jonathan Pollard, I mean, there's been a long-running campaign by the organized Jewish community, by the Jewish state of Israel, to get him pardoned, and Trump was finally the one to cave. There's even a more recent example on a much smaller scale, I think, but still a pretty obvious example of this. This conflict, this, you know, the Jews have, the Jewish media and our educational system have basically convinced everybody to, you know, just the idea of thinking in ethnic terms, especially when it comes to white people or, you know, traditional Americans or traditional Western Europeans or British peoples, that thinking collectively, thinking in racial terms, thinking in ethnic terms is somehow evil. It's like the most evil thing that evil thinking that you can engage in. We're all citizens. We're all potential citizens of the West, apparently, especially if you're non-white. But there's no such thing as like an ethnic American or an ethnic European. Mm-hmm. And that certainly applies to Jews living in the West, living in America, living in Britain. And here's another perfect example. There's like all sorts of violence taking place in Israel, which, of course, is very common. This sort of low-scale civil war amongst the Palestinians and the Israelis. And there was recently an American citizen that was killed in the West Bank, in a West Bank shooting. And this American citizen was named Alon Ganales, mm-hmm. born and grew up in West Hartford, Connecticut. So he apparently was going to join the U.S. military, but opted out, decided to go to Israel and do one of these, I think, what do they call it?
Kibbutz?
No, what do they call it where they go over and they visit Israel and like they discover Israel like when they're in high school or like just graduated high school? The birthright trips.
Oh, okay.
I think he did like one of those, like, you know, birthright trips. Ended up staying in Israel, joined the Israeli military, ended up coming back and going to Colombia and went back, was sort of going back and forth, it sounds like. This article that I'm reading from the Jewish Telegraph Agency said that he was supposed to enlist in the U.S. military, but ended up spending a year in Israel, and he ended up staying in Israel and instead enlisted in the Israel Defense Forces. So, I mean, why is this quote-unquote American citizen enlisting in the military of a foreign country?
Didn't Rahm Emanuel do the same thing?
Yeah.
A similar thing?
There's plenty of examples of this. But I just caught this headline today because the guy, he apparently got killed in a shootout in the West Bank, which, you know, I certainly don't, you know, that's tragic for any family to lose, you know, a son or a daughter or whatever. But, I mean, this just shows you like this total fallacious thinking that we have when it's very clear that especially this particular minority in America and in other Western nations, do they really have their primary loyalty to America or to the West in general? Or are they a nation within a nation, an ethnic community operating very collectively, you know, collaborating and developing talking points and organizing pressure campaigns and, you know, pooling their money together to advance their own unique interests, which they often view as in direct conflict with the interests of the majority nation, America.
Was that a question?
Right. Yeah. Well,
the answer is yes.
The answer is obvious. Well, exactly. And that's what kills me again is like, no matter how obvious this is, you know, it's just still such an obstacle for most people to overcome, and certainly for our politicians to notice or do anything about. And that's probably because they're all blackmailed by this same international criminal network.
Yeah, they're either bribed, blackmailed, or both. And if it's not that, you know what will happen if you cross that line. You'll be canceled. You know, you'll lose your livelihood. And you know, that used to be dynamic science. Now the censorship's more overt now. But yeah, there's as far as that sort of the categorical question that Whitney Webb avoids, tactfully avoids in her book, and I can't blame her really because she's addressing a problem, and maybe it's up to someone else to make that conclusion. That's always a possibility, is he writes in the article, who, what, and why. And he goes, upon finishing volume two, I found that many of the questions raised by Webb still remained open. Who or what is the system that enabled Epstein and protected him from justice? If so many people knew, why was there such an institutional resistance to speak out about Epstein? And the most important question of all, what was the goal behind collecting this sexual blackmail? Webb does not shy away from pointing the finger at Israel or even from discussing wireless Zionist motivations and groups like B'nai B'rith. However, she stops frustratingly short of the obvious conclusions. Granted, the reluctance is one that all those knowledgeable on the Jewish question are familiar with, and perhaps she simply avoids the discussion for the sake of keeping her book on Amazon and appealing to a wider audience rather than have it be relegated to ADL's banned book department. Ultimately, readers are given the impression that this blackmail was collected as a control merely for the sake of control, power merely for the sake of power without a deeper underpinning goal. Then he goes on to say, by referring to Israeli intelligence or Jewish criminals, one is not referring to all Jewish people. One cannot conflate the Epstein network of powerful billionaire Zionists with the whole Jewish community or ascribe any wider group motive to them. Sanzak also exhorts the listener to avoid speaking of groups and instead of only of individuals, lest it breed hate. That's a typical tactic, often a used tactic. One, of course, is allowed to speak of the Chinese or Catholics or Russians in general terms and in a political sense as behaving out of a sense of group identity or a sense of group interest. And it is sophistry to claim that the speaker is referring to every single Catholic in the world or every single Russian in the world, regardless of which sociological theory of power you ascribe to. What it's clearly being referred to is the organized community, the power structure that represents the wider in-group or operates toward a unique in-group goal. In this case of in the case of the Russians, this is currently Putin and the Russian state apparatus, supplemented by the Russian military, media and business elite that do not dissent from the achieving Russian strategic interest as determined by the state apparatus. For Catholics, it is the Vatican and the international network of dioceses, bolstered by the Catholic universities, think tanks, and charities. People are not forced to declare not all Catholics when dealing with the allegation of a cover-up of child sex abuse within the church. When one speaks of the Jews, it stands to reason that the same scenario should apply. It quite reasonably refers to the powerful organized Jewish community, including organizations like the ADL, powerful figures in Israel and the diaspora, as well as the religious and intellectual leaders, the business figures, the lobbying groups. Sure, there are dissenters and outsiders, and of course there is an internal debate and a difference of opinion in the best on the best means for meeting its goals. But the organized Jewish community exists just the same and remains firm in its fundamental goal of ensnaring the security and survival of the Jewish people Now, sorry, in ensuring the security and survival of Jewish people in the state of Israel. I thought that was a very articulate way to describe the situation. To me, it's obvious, but yeah, there's a network, there's an organization, you said. And then he goes on to say, the network of powerful Jewish figures and institutions chronicled throughout Webb's book is a network that is intimately connected to Jeffrey Epstein or to his black law operations, Robert Maxwell, the Pritzker family, Larry Summers, Alan Dershowitz, Ehud Barak, the Israeli intelligence, the world's wealthiest Jewish families that formed the mega group, the Brofman, Lauder, and Wexner families. The list goes on and on. These are not powerless fringe figures or outsiders who are scorned by the Jewish leaders. By Jewish leaders or the wider Jewish community. They are the leaders of the organized Jewish community, some of whom practically direct Jewish American cultural and political, even religious life. To remove them from the equation of power would be the equivalent of removing half of the highest ranking members of the Vatican from the Catholic Church or leading members of the Chinese Communist Party from the Chinese state. Long quote, I'm sorry, but I thought that was an excellent, you know.
No, that's good. I mean, this article was brilliant.
Yeah.
As are pretty much every article appearing on the OccidentalObserver.net, another website I've been following for many, many years. Great, great website. And yeah, I mean, this cuts to the heart of exactly what we've been talking about when it comes to this issue. I mean, again, these people that she's talking about and outlining very, very scholarly, very professional, very, very well. You know, she's a great writer. These are not some random individual Jews. These are like the movers and shakers in the organized international Jewish community. Mm-hmm. Maxwell, the Pricksters.
He's the governor of Illinois.
I was
going to
say, it's governor. Yeah, exactly, the governor of Illinois.
Yeah.
From what I understand, that family is one of the bankrolling families behind the whole transgender movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and again, these are things that are very, very well documented, including by their own organizations and foundations. So the people described in this book, in this, you know, the Jeffrey Epstein network, are not these like fringe, you know, random Jews that just happen to be Jewish or something. They are fundamentally, you know, motivated by a desire to advance the interests of the Jewish people, to advance the interests of the state of Israel. And they do this ruthlessly. I mean, this is like what drives every single waking moment of their life, it seems like, anyways. And that's certainly the way they come across to me. So yeah, to leave this out of the equation or the analysis, to me is just, I mean, you're not really getting to the heart of the matter. And again, I'm not, you know, blaming Webb or anything for that. I'm just saying, like, if you want to really go all the way, you have to come to this conclusion that this is an organized international network. It's no secret. I mean, just do a little bit of research, read the book, and it's all, you know, spelled out in black and white right there for you. The names are named, you know, the organizations are named. And the obvious conclusion is that these people operate to advance their own unique interests.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very cunning and conniving and dedicated and motivated. And again, ruthless in their endeavor. And that's something that we might want to pay attention to. We might want to consider. We might want to organize ourselves if we're not part of this network to do something about. And, you know, hopefully at some point we can actually get there politically. You know, white people, I've often said, I mean, like looking at like the political situation in the West, it's like, especially, I mean, primarily in America. I mean, I'm an American. I focus much of my attention here, most of my attention in this country. You know, it's especially the past like 10 years, 15 years, it's just so obvious that it's like this multiracial empire at this point. And all of the different groups are organized and working to advance their interests, especially the Jews. And white people are sitting on the sidelines with these fake organizations that don't even genuinely represent them, like the Republicans or the Democrats,
mm-hmm.
or they're tied into their football team or their basketball team or something. So it's like we're in this like racial struggle, and I think that is an accurate way to characterize it. And we're not even like fielding a team. We're just like on the sidelines, like just getting our asses kicked, and nobody's even paying attention or noticing what's going on. And the very few people that do recognize it and say something about it, you know, however, you know, in whatever meager way that they can, are looked at as like these crazed, you know, conspiracy theorists or something. I mean, I think that is certainly changing. And, you know, the alternative independent media has played a key role in that. But really, that's still sort of where we're at. I mean, I look at like, you know, a group like the National Justice Party, for example, and I know, you know, certain people have criticisms of them or whatever, but I mean, at least that's an organization that is not afraid to make these connections, to call these people out, to openly discuss these issues and openly advocate for white working people. And I think that is a huge step in the right direction. Aside from a group like that, I don't really see much else out there, at least, you know, organized politically in a way like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you have, like, recently Scott Adams, the creator of Dilbert, made some waves on his YouTube program, I think it's YouTube, about blacks. And, of course, I think when you're blaming blacks, you're shadow boxing, because they're proxies for this power structure that we're talking about. This isn't to say there's any problem there, but he called out this poll that said that as many as half of American blacks don't think it's okay to be white. And he said, this is a hate group. And he's fed up with blacks. And he's told whites the way to deal with this is get the F away from them. And then he gets canceled. But he's responding to a poll that obviously exposed racist attitudes among almost half of that population, admitting to it. Isn't that the problem? Not Scott Adams saying, exactly. Remember, Scott Adams is saying, just get away. It's a defensive act. White flight's a defensive act. It's not aggressive. But as Jesse Jackson said, wherever you go, we're going to find you. Because civil rights really is the demand for proximity to whites. That's what it boils down to. And you know, the black population in America has been used by the Jewish power structure for decades. You know,
oh, absolutely.
Exploiting real grievances. I mean, I would say, I'm not, this isn't to say there aren't legitimate grievances, but the way they were handled perhaps wasn't the best way. Like the Civil Rights Act and all these course of laws and destroying federalism and you know, integration, forced integration was just an invitation for trouble. And of course, that was anticipated and desired because there was one way that you blockbusting, you broke up neighborhoods and engaged in more social engineering to create the atomized whites today, which now no longer have any representation because whiteness isn't, unless you're being blamed for something, white isn't a legitimate identity, unless you're being blamed for something like all the world's problems.
Yeah.
Like I said, we can point out this network of Jewish, the involvement of powerful Jews and organizations in virtually every destructive, subversive, cause in the past 67 years. We can name names, cite legal cases, addresses, speeches, these things, and point that and just say, and they'll say, you're just blaming everything on the Jews. But at the same time, they're blaming everything on whites, and that's accepted.
Right, exactly. It's like a total double standard.
Yeah.
You know, and speaking of that, are you familiar with the website JewishContributions.com?
No. But,
oh, boy, it's an outstanding website. They put together these like,
it's one of those websites where you take their quotes and use it against them or something.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, it's really good. It's outstanding, actually. And they have a lot of very good info tables and just, you know, simple images that you could share on social media or, you know, whatever, even put up on your website if you wanted to, mm-hmm. or just download and have, you know, as collect them. You could probably make a whole book out of this. It's pretty incredible. And what really struck me is that pretty much all of the quotes and the information that they come up with is sourced directly from Jewish outlets. You know, explicitly like Jewish publications or Jewish authors or writers or whatever. And that's something that I started doing on my website years ago in a column. I had a section on my website. I still have a section on my website called News from the Jews, where I'm just going through and reading the Jewish press. And that is pretty much the only press that I follow, at least like sort of, I guess, quote unquote, mainstream press. I pretty much just follow explicitly Jewish outlets to see their angle on things, because you will find some incredible and very, very revealing articles coming from the organized Jewish community, coming from the explicitly Jewish press. And this website does a great job of putting together, you know, little info tables and little images with good quotes and other information about Jewish contributors to America and you know, what they've done and some of the causes that they've championed. And I know we've been speaking quite a bit about, you know, sexual blackmail and sexual degeneracy in general. And they have a really interesting info table on the adult film industry in America, how it came to exist, how it was allowed to flourish and basically take over American society. And it's thanks almost entirely to a work of Jewish trailblazers. Mm-hmm. And they have a list. I mean, and, you know, I'm not going to sit here and read the whole thing, but it's just, I mean, you know, these are very, very well documented facts that most people, again, just simply are never confronted with. They don't know about it. Maybe if they do hear about it, they, you know, dismiss it as some, you know, anti-Semitic conspiracy theory or something like that. But no, it's actually true. And this goes for pornography. It goes for feminism. It goes for the breakup of the family. It even goes for, like, the people that were behind creating birth control. I know you've interviewed Mike King of Real History Channel.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a great website. A great feature of his website is the anti-New York Times. And I've been following his work for a very long time as well. And he put up a couple articles over the course of the past month. One was a piece about the father of the abortion pill, a French man. Well, I should say a French man. That's not even an accurate way to describe this man. He's a Jew who was born in France. And apparently he was involved in the French resistance. So he's like a far left, you know, communist sympathizing Jew that was in the French resistance during World War II. And he's known as the father of the abortion pill. And in this piece that I'm referring to, Mike King also talks about two other individuals, Carl Jassari. I'm not even sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. He was also known as the father of the birth control pill. And then another Jew named Gregory Pincus, who also made that claim. All three of these individuals are Jews. They're doctors that were involved in developing chemicals that basically manipulate a woman's body to prevent her from being able to have a baby.
And this would undermine Christian teachings of sexual morals and all that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's had a devastating impact on females in America, on not only females, on everybody in
everybody,
America.
Everybody, yeah. The contraceptive culture, of course, produced the abortion culture. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, and then if we look at, you know, who is responsible for promoting abortion. Again, it's basically a group of radical Jewish activists that were behind the promotion and elevation and normalization of abortion, which, I mean, I still struggle to even intellectually wrap my mind around how anybody could characterize abortion other than snuffing out a living being. I just don't understand how anybody could look at abortion and not at its essence, that is what abortion is. It is murdering a potential child, you know, and I know there's all sorts of circumstances that play into it, but at the end of the day, I don't look at abortion any other. I don't know how you could look at abortion any other way. I mean, you really have to go through.
Well,
some
abortion on demand,
gymnastics.
Abortion on demand doesn't exist to deal with hard cases. Abortion on demand exists as a fallback for contraception and to get rid of unwanted pregnancy. That was a product of obviously of illicit sexual intercourse. In most cases, very few married women get abortions, you know. So it's not the hard cases that abortion exists for. That's not, even the initial case for Roe v. Wade, Norma McCorvey was the actual woman, but she was picked up by a few attorneys to make, and she made the false claim that she was raped. And that wasn't the case. So they always make the hard case to try to, you know, ram the law through. And you're right, it was Jewish activism, almost to a man. Bernard Nathanson writes about that, you know, in his book, The Hand of God. He eventually converted to Catholicism, but he wrote about that. And when he was a Jew promoting abortion, he was all over the place. When he converted to Catholicism against abortion, the media forgot him. And
right.
One of the tactics that they'd used in the abortion debates of the 60s and 70s was if you were a pro-life activist or anti-abortion, they immediately identify you as a Christian or a Catholic. But they would never identify a pro-abortion activist as a Jew or a feminist activist as a Jew. Well, you know, they're all Jewish. Betty Friedan, these are all Jewish operations.
Well, and that's so true. And it's not merely the fact that they're Jews that are doing all these things and behind all these movements. It's the fact that they're doing it for a reason and they're motivated primarily by their Jewish identity.
Well, they're revolutionaries by their identity.
Right. Yeah.
The subversive revolution by their identity. E. Michael Jones has a theory that ultimately it goes back to the foot of the cross, the rejection of Christ, the Logos of the universe. And so you reject Logos in the universe, you're gonna reject all of society's norms, values, and rules. You're going to try to undermine those things. And then the whole idea of the diaspora, and this is where Kevin MacDonald's research is useful, about the idea of the people that should dwell alone. This sort of diaspora roaming people that never belonged to any particular nation. There was the outsiders. and they do very well by undermining any culture or any society that is homogeneous. Because if a homogeneous culture, they're going to be noticed for being different. In a heterodox or a diverse culture that the ADL supports, the ADL's motto is what, diversity is our strength. Yes, it's their strength. They can blend in, especially in a society where they preach individualism, extreme atomism, or individualism. The individual actually loses any corporate protection or representation, whether it be his family, his community, his church, his ethnic group, and these things. These are representations, corporate representations that individuals need to vindicate their individual rights. The individual is only vindicated, fulfilled with the group, because human beings are social beings. They're animals. They're political animals. They need our competitive advantage with the beasts is our ability to organize, therefore to collect, to form a collective strength. That's how we kill polar bears or wolves and these things. And so you're denied that collective representation. You're pretty much you're like you're out there in the wilderness by yourself. And that's why the Jews support allegedly support individualism. Like they support, unbridled free speech when it can tear down an institution, when it can bring down and when it can deconstruct and tear things down. But the moment you invoke or try to use free speech to criticize them, critique them, it becomes hate speech, and then the repressive tolerance kicks in, and they no longer support free speech.
Yeah, and they literally want to make it illegal to even criticize or notice things about Jews. It's really gotten to that point. And they've been successful in certain countries, very unfortunately. And they're pushing to do that here in America as well. And yeah, you're making a lot of really good points. And one thing that's always struck me is it's always one thing for the goyim and quite another thing for the Jews. For example, there's no diversity in Israel, at least, in the parts of the country that they fully control. And if they had their way, they'd get rid of all the Palestinians, tomorrow. They don't promote diversity in Israel. It's only for the West. And that's one thing that I always try to emphasize is that, look, you may, like, if you're talking to like an average person, like you may like sort of vaguely support the idea of diversity. You have, black friends or Mexican friends or whatever. And we all do. I think all, any normal American person operating in society today has had positive social interactions with non-whites. And I'm not saying that that's a good or a bad thing. It just is what it is. The fact is that there's an agenda behind all of this. And if you don't recognize that, you will never understand what is going on and how you are being targeted, especially as a white person, because you are denied that very same right. You are denied to the ability to collectively organize, or not even to collectively organize, but to think of it as it, like in an abstract, like intellectual term, like can we even like think collectively as whites? Like, do we even have interests? What are our interests? You're not even allowed to do that because that's, evil and connected to Hitler and the Nazis and this totally false, entirely weaponized narrative of history. So that to me really is the main point. And you see this in the quotes directly from the Jews. For example, I have this, since I have this pulled up on the screen from JewishContributions.com. Again, this is a quote from the infographic about the adult film industry in America and, how Jews were behind promoting pornography and all these other like sexual degeneracy in general. And here's a quote from Al Goldstein, who is probably one of the most notorious Jewish pornographers, who died, I think, I know he died maybe 10 years ago or so. But this is a quote from him. He was in an interview with I think with another with Luke Ford, actually, who, if I'm not mistaken, was born a Christian, but did he convert to Judaism? I don't. There's something like that happened at some point in his career. But anyways, I know he did a lot of interviews with people involved in the pornography industry, including Al Goldstein, and he said here, this is a quote: "The only reason that Jews are in pornography is that we think that Christ sucks, Catholicism sucks. We don't believe in authoritarianism. Pornography thus becomes a way of defiling Christian culture. And as it penetrates to the very heart of the American mainstream and is no doubt consumed by those very same wasps, its subversive character becomes more charged. Porn is no longer of the what the butler saw voyeuristic type. Instead, it is driven to new extremes of portrayal that stretch the boundaries of the porn aesthetic. As new sexual positions are portrayed, the desire to shock as well as entertain seems clear." I mean, if that just doesn't you know, give you an insight into the twisted mind of this Jewish pornographer, who again is very ethnocentric, very aware of his Jewish identity, and how using pornography as a weapon, as a cultural, basically cultural terrorism. This is a cultural terrorist that we're dealing with here.
Yeah, it's a very similar term. Obviously, you know, Philip Roth wasn't a pornographer, but you know, he's one of Portnoy's Complaint and Goodbye Columbus. I think it's the Portnoy's Complaint was the inspiration for Woody Allen's Annie Hall, 1977, which won, I think, the first comedy to win Best Picture. And he wrote something similar when he was having sex with shishkas, if you will. He said, I wasn't sticking it just to her. I was sticking it to the WASP establishment, the Puritans that founded this country. ethnic resentment. Yeah.
Yeah, they make it, no bones about it. And you could find similar quotes from these radical Jewish activists, behind transgenderism or open borders or, you know, LGBTQ plus rights, all these things. Oh, you know what? I was also going to mention, I came across this earlier as well, again, from Mike King, realhistorychan.com. This was a more recent article. He profiled – the New York Times profiled a guy named Charles Silverman, a Jew who helped destigmatize homosexuality. He was like at the forefront, in helping to persuade the American Psychiatric mm-hmm. Association to reassess its classification of homosexuality as a mental disorder, which is how it had previously been classified, right? And I think
that was a Jewish coup inside the American Psychological Association. Yeah,
right. Yeah. Exactly.
There was no scientific finding. They were just pure politics at the time. They kind of like wore everyone down in making that classification change in the diagnostic statistical model.
Exactly.
But
this Jew, I was just going to say real quick, this Jew, this Silverstein, he wrote some, listen to these titles. This is some of the books that he wrote. The Joy of Gay Sex, Man to Man, A Parent's Guide to Homosexuality. So we were seeing books like this come out. This was back in like the 70s and the 80s. Mm-hmm. And now, I mean, you know, it's certainly much worse than it was back then, much more prevalent in society anyways. But these are the and again, it's not just that, you know, this is a Jewish individual, you know, behind this. It's the fact that, again, fundamentally driven by their Jewish identity to transform white Gentile society to suit the interests of Jews and to harm the interests of the white Christian minority.
Yeah, and of course, you know, promoting something like homosexual sex, homosexual lifestyle, it's consistent with the contraceptive approach to contraception, because the goal there is sterile sex. And then sex becomes just merely pleasure. And when that's the case, if you just view that as a mere pleasure, you have no principal objection to homosexuality other than the yuck factor. It all gets that degeneration of society, literal degeneration, because people simply aren't procreating anymore. And we've seen it throughout the West in the United States, where the replacement, the birth rate isn't replacement level for the native population. So we're told, you got to bring in people from all around the world, all corners of the world, to make up the difference and make life harder so people don't want to procreate or form families. At the same time, promoting a cultural agenda with entertainment and music and also education, which corrupts the sexual morals of society further. We talked about child sex rings with the Franklin scandal and Epstein, and those were actually weren't children, they were young girls, but they were minors in many cases. Kind of a different operation, but nevertheless, it's disgusting. But you also see the Jewish agenda to promote to morally subvert society, primarily through sexual titillation, through entertainment, mm-hmm. and these things. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of that's because they've been unchecked since the 1960s. When the production code collapsed.
Absolutely, yeah. I really look at the major turning point. I mean, there were already problems prior to World War II, but I really look at World War II as just being the one of the most pivotal events in history, and the total Jewish takeover of virtually every aspect of Western civilization at that point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, in the aftermath, we saw nothing but, you know, sexual liberation and open borders and just open anti-white attacks on you know, certainly in America, but also in Western Europe. And just the floodgates were opened up. And we've seen how, you know, you make these points very, very well in most of your podcasts, how sexual liberation is basically code word for political, social, and cultural control. And, you know, sexual degeneracy, you know, basically the same thing. And we see how sexual degeneracy is used for political blackmail, mm-hmm. and political control. And I mean, these concepts, I mean, just total sexual liberation and promiscuity and degeneracy, which is the absolute norm in America and the wider and Western world at this point. This is, again, we've been making these points ad nauseum for the past 30 minutes, totally facilitated almost exclusively by Jews. And again, not only Jews, but Jews that were very aware of their identity and very concerned about the, you know, their group interests. And they've totally erased any sort of social shame or stigma associated with these very unhealthy, very promiscuous, in some cases entirely unnatural and unbiblical sexual or lifestyle practices. I mean, that's been totally thrown out the window, and it's had just a total negative repercussion for society. And it's so obvious to anybody that's walking around the streets in America today.
Well, this goes back to as early as 1950 with the American Jewish Committee's publication of The Authoritarian Personality. And I think the concluding chapter talks about this. And basically, they use arrows to undermine society, basically corrupt sexual morals of society. And this is insights that were made by someone like Wilhelm Reich back in the 1920s and 30s in Germany or in Austria, where you wouldn't bother debating theology with a seminarian student. You talk sex, and that's you get everyone listening, and you corrupt them sexually, and the idea of God will just kind of go away. And that's how you and the authoritarian personality is said that basically the germ seed of fascism is the father figure and the nuclear family, and so you shatter the father figure's moral authority, and then you solve the problem of authoritarianism, because you do away with authority and hierarchy within the family. So basically what they were saying was an unhealthy family was the problem. So the way you solve the problem is you destroy the family and you make everyone unhealthy. And to them, that's a free society. That's the open society, as George Soros would call it.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Yeah. Really good points. You know, one point that, speaking of Dr. Kevin MacDonald, we've mentioned him previously, one of the points that was really critical in understanding how this all works is how, through the authoritarian personality and just cultural Marxism in general, it was not only like a total assault on traditional Western civilization and our social norms, religious norms, sexual norms, all these things, but it ultimately resulted in a pathologization of just being a normal heterosexual white Christian male. Or female, for that matter. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a total like inversion to where if you were actually normal, you were somehow evil or twisted in some way or you know, somehow in the wrong. You know what I mean? Things really got totally just inverted. And I think all of these things that you're discussing sort of play a role in that.
Well,
And I was going to say, even today, when it comes to like the whole sexual promiscuous culture, you look at like these dating apps that everybody's on, mm-hmm. and like even the dating apps were like founded by Jews, mm-hmm. you know, just facilitating this hookup culture, which is helping nobody and just, you know, everybody's miserable. And, you know, it's just a total destruction of society. And,
well, even like with feminism, which is there to pathologize, well, one thing is masculinity. And at the same time, they're promoting pornography. You know, they're promoting Playboy, they're promoting Penthouse and Screw magazine and Penthouse and these things. And at least back then, the feminists pretended to oppose pornography as exploitation of women. That was the phase then. But what you were doing was you were pathologizing masculinity. And again, at the same time attacking masculinity, attacking it, the idea of men being provider protector. And what happens is the men no longer seek any get any reward or status from it. They stop being masculine. This engenders contempt from women, and women are no longer attracted to men anymore. And by nature, the women are going to have to become more masculine because then they can no longer pretend on the male to provide and protect. This happens in nature. And so the females become more masculine, and then the men aren't attracted to the women as much. And what does that result in? You know,
Modern America in 2023.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, well,
incels, it's lesbianism, yeah. Transgenderism. At the same time, these oligarchs, they promote a media, basically a propaganda campaign in academia, in news, in science, in med schools, in entertainment to promote transgenderism. All of a sudden, now you have more kids identifying as transgenderism. Well, yeah, because basically you destroyed any reward or acknowledgement for healthy, normal male behavior, female behavior. At the same time, you put out all these rewards, all these social cues or acknowledgement that if you're a little weird, you're going to be special, especially if you're a white kid, right? If you're a white kid.
Exactly.
And so all of a sudden now, and you know, they're taking these polls. What do you identify as? By the way, when I was in school, no one asked what I identify as. The question itself is an assault. It's a leading question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that itself, the fact that schools, and this goes, you know, to how society now is grooming and sexualizing kids in earlier ages. And so sort of it's not just these satanic child sex trafficking networks that we have to worry about. It's society in general. It's the power structure. We have schools now. There's an article, Gavin Newsom's wife has made like $1.5 million in the past 10 years on some transgender program that she's force fed the school system in California. And they're showing kids gay pornography in schools. And that's part of the education program that Gavin Newsom's current wife is cashing in on. A teacher recently was fired because she refused to lie to a kid and indulge his transgender fantasy. And basically, you know, what it was there were teachers told not to tell parents that kids were asking to identify as another sex that they actually are. And she wouldn't lie to parents, so she was fired for that. These are school systems doing this.
Yeah, this is America in the current year.
And what was it? The Attorney General.
It's shameful.
The Attorney General of Michigan, Dana Nessel, says she goes. She says, "Drag queen story hour is great. Every school should have drag queen story hour. It's fun." And this is and then she goes on to say, "It helps kids deal with their problems." Well, Dana, what problems do kids have? What role do you have in promoting these problems? Being a Jewish activist who's posing as Attorney General, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's outrageous. You know, I was going to mention one other thing. I went through my my original blog that I set up has been totally deleted by Google, and I've been kind of working on trying to go back and get the archive version of some older posts. And anyways, I came across this post that I did back in June. It was June 28, 2015. The headline here is "The Tattoo Business as We Know It Was Largely Created by Jews." And I don't know if you know this, but most people aren't aware, but even the tattoo industry this was is like totally, totally like spearheaded by Jews in America that had recently come to America.
So they atomize society, destroy identity, destroy community. So people have to identify through tattoos, and in the process, society gets uglier and uglier and more perverse.
But yeah, basically.
Yeah.
And think about how prevalent tattoos are anymore. I mean,
I watch. Yeah, I noticed.
My
that.
Goodness, it doesn't matter where you go. You know, there's a lot of people that have tattoos, and I'm not going to judge anybody if they have a tattoo. It, you know, it's your decision. I frankly don't find them very attractive, at least in most cases.
There's no improvement.
But again,
there's no way you can improve the human body by painting it permanently. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
And it seems like most people wind up regretting it anyways. But anyways, here's just another aspect of this overall cultural assault on our country, on mm-hmm. our civilization. Spearheaded by Jews. This is, you know, maybe one relatively minor aspect of it, but still, it's astonishing. And this comes directly from a Jewish outlet called the Tablet Magazine, which is sort of like a more like a highbrow, you know, intellectual type, you know, news outlet, a Jewish news outlet, I should say, an explicitly Jewish news outlet. And here they are admitting, you know, Jews and tattoos, they basically founded the whole industry.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's pretty incredible. No matter how well documented this stuff is, it's still difficult for people to wrap their minds around, despite the obvious consequences before our eyes. I mean, I think, you know, if anything, the whole train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, if it proved everything, it's that nobody trusts what the media or government are saying about anything anymore.
No.
And that's, I mean, I guess a good thing. It's just, you know, I wish they were, you know, listening to people like you or me more often than some of the other gatekeepers out there. But really, that's where we're at today, is people recognize just how far we have just totally derailed. I mean, in fact,
No
the
pun
most recent,
intended.
yeah, I mean, the most recent article that I wrote for American Free Press, the front page article in the most recent edition of the newspaper, is titled "America Derailed," and that's like a big point, you know, of the article, is just how totally just off the deep end we have gone as a country. We can't even, you know, keep our rail lines intact anymore. It's just
Well, at the same
total
time, you have
disgrace.
Janet Yellen flying over to Ukraine, hand over $1 billion to the Jewish government in Ukraine that the United States government installed at the behest of Victoria Nuland back in 2014, who's Jewish. And of course, Janet Yellen's Jewish. But then again, no, has any money flowed into East Palestine yet?
Very, very little, if
Yeah.
anything. Yeah, has there been a? Well, see, and even that's the thing. Like that's the crisis that America finds itself in. Is even these organizations that are sent out there to do these investigations, like the EPA, for example, or I don't know if FEMA is involved yet. I know there were some demands for FEMA to get involved, but even these sorts of organizations, certainly in the wake of this COVID scamdemic, nobody even trusts these organizations
Yeah.
anymore. These are not professional scientists or engineers or you know,
Well,
professionals in general.
the transportation secretary got his job because he's a homosexual.
Yeah, exactly. That just
It's,
shows you.
and Joe Biden said that.
Yeah, exactly.
He, that's it. That's his qualification for the job. It's just like the qualification for the White House communications director. He's a homosexual. He's queer. Okay.
Right.
Then you have,
Female, lesbian, Haitian immigrant, I think. You know, it's
Yes.
like you checked off like three of the boxes there. You're hired.
Now, she has a tough job. She tries to make, she's trying to be a spokesperson for this administration, which is a train wreck. I mean,
She's trying to defend the indefensible, no
yes.
matter how you look at it. Yeah, boy, it is certainly a total
Well,
embarrassment.
by the way, she had, what, didn't she? Isn't her lover some news, so-called journalist or something? So,
Right.
I mean, yeah, it's a cesspool, and they're partying like it's the hot tub,
Exactly. Yeah, it's a disgrace, and we're never gonna, you know, straighten this shit back out unless we start, you know, talking about these admittedly controversial topics, no doubt about that,
Well, if
but
someone asks me, do you blame everything on them? I'm not blaming everything on them. There's enough problems in the world without them, but let's deal with the problems that they're responsible for, at least to the extent that their participation in these problems, because obviously, they're a very tiny portion of the global population, so they require the vast majority of the population to go along with it. So you have whether they're Shabbos goy or clueless goy, they're helping them participate in it. So that's not the only problem. But I would say, hey, let's do something. Let's start by, holding them accountable or holding them to a higher standard or excluding them and see what happens.
Yep, exactly.
Let's see what happens.
Let's start by first just talking about the basic facts and you know, who's actually in these positions of power and, you know, what sort of agendas they're pushing. I mean, you just take a look at the Biden administration. There's a great infographic, by the way, on JewishContributions.com of the Biden administration. And I remember reading an article back in, I think it was the Jewish Telegraph Agency, shortly after he was quote unquote elected and announced his cabinet. And I mean, it's like, seven of the 10 are Jew. I mean, it's just like
The key positions,
outrageous.
yeah,
Yeah,
treasury,
of like
yeah.
the key positions. Yeah,
And
exactly.
then you have to
And
look at like assistant secretaries and like that.
well,
So
and then the main handler, like the chief of staff, Kanye West was totally right about these handlers controlling the president, these Jewish handlers
yeah, he's had two
controlling the
chief of
president.
staffs, and they're both were Jewish.
Yeah, I think it was oh, what was it?
Klain, Ron Klain, and the new
Ron
guys.
Klain and then Zients, I think, or
Yeah,
Z something.
Zients or something. Yeah, is
Yeah.
Jewish. So,
Yeah, and
what
he
are the
was
odds?
Yeah, exactly. And he was involved, the new guy, Zients, he was involved in the COVID response. I mean, this guy's definitely up to no good.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, you look at these people, you know, it's not just that they're Jews, it's that they are motivated primarily by their Jewish ethnic identity that is foundational to who they are and what they do as bureaucrats, as politicians, as activists, as bankers, as whatever role they're playing in society, as child sex traffickers and blackmailers in the case of Jeffrey Epstein, who we, you know, talked about previously.
Well, it's all necessary for the furtherance of a Jewish interest in the Israeli state, so it's all justified.
Yes, that's certainly the way that
and
they
at the same time, they've used their cultural power, they've leveraged their financial power to get political power and also cultural power in Hollywood and entertainment and news. And this has further undermined the morals of society. There was a time there was something called the Production Code. And there's the Legions of Decency that was largely ethnically based. And they acknowledged that the reality of the American society was ethnic warfare. Basically, it was Catholic, WASP, Jewish in America in the 20th century. But it was Joe Breen. He was a Catholic who headed the production code, and he called them out about Hollywood, and he said there are simply a rotten bunch of vile people with no respect for anything beyond making money. Here in Hollywood, we have paganism rampant in its most virulent form. Drunkenness and debauchery are commonplace. Sexual perversion is rampant. Any number of our directors and stars are perverts. These Jews seem to think of nothing but money making and sexual indulgence. The vilest kind of sin is common indulgence hereabouts, and the men and women who engage in this sort of business are the men and women who decide the film fare for the nation, what the film fare of the nation is to be, that they alone make the decision. 95% of these folks are Jews of an Eastern European lineage. They are probably the scum of the earth.
Well said, sir.
And you need – that's the type of dialogue, Catholic, Jewish, Christian, Jewish, Gentile, Jewish dialogue you need. Speak to them on those terms. And you might be able to deal with them because at that point, you know what the score is. Right now, we're living in this fantasy where that ethnic identity doesn't mean anything. It's not supposed to mean anything, and it does. One thing that we saw back in Los Angeles, remember a couple months ago in Los Angeles, that city council hearing? Did you hear about that?
Yeah, yeah.
Now they're all talking in ethnic terms.
Yeah, like the Hispanics are teaming up with the blacks and the Jews. Yeah, yeah. Yep.
That's the reality. And you're better off, believe it, we have a much healthier political dialogue in this country if we spoke in honest terms.
Well, and it shows you how that situation was very revealing for a number of reasons. But number one, primarily to me, was the fact that virtually all of them were Democrats. So they put on this like total fake facade of like being, you know, colorblind, except for when it comes to white people, of course, for being responsible for all the world's evils. But, you know, they put on this facade, and then behind the scenes, they're like these race hustlers that are consciously aware, very much aware of the ethnic component in politics and just advancing racial grievances or racial agendas. And that is what drives them, and that's what drives their political wheeling and dealing. And that was made very, very clear.
Yeah, there was Peter Kionis makes the point. He says, quite often, if you talk about black crime or Jews, we'll say we're not talking about everyone, okay? But when they talk about white people, they say everyone.
Yep, every time.
Everyone. And so, you know, obviously nothing's ever that simple, but it doesn't address the broader point. You know, it's... Again, you're not – again, they've controlled the narrative, and they control the narrative public discourse by being able to, accuse you of anti-Semitism and all of that means because of the narrative of the 20th century. And it is interesting that quote from Joe Breen I cited was from before World War II.
Yeah, when you could actually make statements like that, and it wouldn't be this huge scandal, you know, across the whole country.
Yeah,
yeah, no, the whole anti-Semitism industry, and that's really what it's become over the course of the past couple decades, and certainly in more recent years. This is like another multi-million, maybe billion-dollar industry that the Jews have created. There was a fascinating article that just came out in the Jewish Daily Forward, I think just today or yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Profiling this Jewish billionaire from South Africa who made a ton of money working with the quote-unquote apartheid government in South Africa that's so demonized these days. But here's this Jew making a bunch of money. I think he bought some Israeli arms firm directly from the Israeli government and had connections to the Israeli government. And
oh, they made tons of money like during the sanctions era.
Oh yeah,
because they got absolutely. The sanctions imposed and they were able to sell at a much higher price arms to the South African government in the 70s and 80s. Yeah.
Yeah, there was a lot of corruption between the Jews and apartheid South Africa for sure. And this guy's name is what was his name? Natty. His name, the organization, he's funding this organization to the tune of, I think like $4 million, Shine a Light. And they came out with this like 30-second ad, which basically was saying that quote unquote rising anti-Semitism is either being ignored or treated as legitimate discourse. And it's just like the way they frame things is just so infuriating and really, I guess, sort of brilliant from like a psychological warfare perspective, because they want people to think that literally any like discussion of Jews, even like bringing up the word Jew or saying the word Jewish or pointing out like basic facts or criticizing them in any way is like verboten. You know, it's unacceptable. It's not fit for polite society. And they have millions of dollars invested in this entire industry to perpetuate this idea. And anyways, I thought that was just an interesting article. But you see articles like this all the time about these anti-Semitism campaigns. And there's organizations that are operating across the country, training police, working directly with mayors and state, you know, state.
Well, the FBI, the ADL, which controls the FBI more or less. But in order to get a badge as an FBI agent, you have to go to the Holocaust Museum.
Right.
I think and pay the $17 fare to get in. You have to pay out of your pocket, but they train local law enforcement about hate speech, all that stuff, all the ADL agenda. Here's a good example: intersectionality, which is gives you a good glimpse into the Jewish world behind mass immigration, gay rights, LGBTQ, Black Lives Matter, and all that. There was a recent, I forget what city it was, but there was a drag queen story hour, and the Proud Boys showed up to protest it, and. Well, the ADL came out in defense of the Drag Queen Story Hour. Now, what does Drag Queen Story have to do with Jewish interests or anti-defamation? Well, because Jews are pushing Drag Queen Story Hour, that degeneracy. And, you know, and the ADL is big into that and promoting, and again, grooming kids in schools. They sell a curriculum that's bought by public schools that promotes tolerance of degenerate, perverse behavior, which is the grooming of children. Because you tell kids that's okay, that's the grooming of a child to accept it, so they can be more easily manipulated. They can be, easily exploited. At the very least, rob them of a moral discernment and moral outlook on life that will make them critical thinking citizens. They'll be, uncritical, mindless consumers of Jewish entertainment, Jewish media, you know. And that's where you get this whole, again, the corruption of society, which then renders everyone more vulnerable to these things. And society breaks down and families break down. More kids are more subject to trauma and abuse, which, again, will create more homosexuals, more transgender students, more confused individuals who won't have the wherewithal to question Jewish power. That's the game.
Absolutely. That's it in a nutshell.
You know. What more can I say?
I know. That's the thing. It's like, geez, like this stuff is so.
Except if I'm not just throwing out an accusation. If I can point to the research, the names, the organizations, the foundations that are promoting this, whether it's mass immigration, transgenderism, homosexuality, feminism, these things in schools.
Drag Queen Story Hour.
That's the Haas Foundation.
By the way. Yeah, exactly. By the way, in early January, I think that story that you just mentioned a few moments ago was actually in New York. I think it was in Queens.
Okay.
And here's an article from, again, the Jewish Telegraph Agency. You can tell I follow the Jewish press pretty closely. Here's the headline. These Jews are defending Drag Queen Story Hour against far-right protesters. Here's why. And it's this, you know, detailed article about all these and a lot of them are like Antifa types. They're far left radicals and they're very strongly influenced by their Jewish identity. In fact, that is what is driving their activism. It even basically says that right in the title of the article, you know. Mm-hmm. And yet you tell people this, or you start looking into this and wondering why are Jews so concerned about drag queen story hour as Jews? Like, it's something intrinsically like unique to their identity or something.
Yeah, the U.S. Department of Education has Assistant Secretary of Civil Rights Catherine Lehman. I'm not sure what her ethnicity is, but she's busy at work making sure parents don't have any rights. Basically, she's promoting under Title IX. She's promoting encouraged gender transitions in schools, awareness in public schools. This is the U.S. government promoting this. And there's no one ever wrote this into law. So this is just she's inveigled herself or found herself in the bureaucracy. Now she's promoting it, you know.
Right.
But, you know, it's something. I mean, see this in history. History echoes if it doesn't repeat. But this is very similar to something that happened like in Germany in the 1920s. During war.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know,
something was described like this in the Bible, Sodom and Gomorrah, something like that. Like, yeah.
Well, the Weimar was sort of a dress rehearsal for the sexual revolution. And of course that ended, for a while, then World War II occurred. And then post-war Germany was subject to even more sophisticated psychological warfare. Both regarding their identity, their guilt, and also sexual corruption of the German people in the 50s and 60s, which leads to Germany now, which doesn't have the wherewithal to defend its own interests. You know, they'll silent them when their pipelines are being blown up by their supposed ally, the United States.
Yeah, well, I'd say most Americans aren't too far behind them.
No,
it's a very, very sad state of affairs. And, you know, if you're genuinely interested in figuring out why we've gotten to this point, I mean, you have to address these topics. There's no other way around it. You're never going to get the full story, the full picture, the full history, you know, the behind the scenes history, and unless you're just openly willing to confront this very, very taboo subject.
Yeah, I mean, I run into this with Catholics where they'll lament everything that they're seeing, but they won't understand why it's happening. You know, they see it as perverse, immoral, and weird, but the problem is you don't understand the organizations, the agency, the power dynamics behind it. And so, you know, if you read anything like The Art of War, if you don't know the enemy, you're not going to be able to engage the enemy. You're not going to win the war. That's why they've been losing the culture war. That's why, you know, the Christians have been losing the culture war to the Jews, you know, the past 60, 70 years.
Yeah, that's right. And again, unless you're going to confront it head on, you're going to continue to lose the culture war and the political war, the economic war, and every other war for that matter.
It's that category. Yeah, you got to be able to identify that category. You know, it's not going to solve all the problems in the world, you know, because man's fallen nature, there's concupiscence, and, you know, these things. So people are sinful and weak. One of the reasons why they fall easy prey to sort of the solicitations of the Jews, because they're weak. It's not justification for the exploitation. You know, there was a time when there was enough a consciousness that there were barriers set up to protect you from doing this, but that collapsed, you know, in the 19th century with liberalism. You know, we're not allowed to have it. It's illiberal to entertain such things. So basically, in the name of liberalism, you have to succumb to a Jewish dictatorship.
you have to tolerate Jews telling you what to think, how to think, what you can and can't think about, how you're going to run your government, mm-hmm. you know, what you're going to watch on television and Hollywood, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so if you don't want that, like, I made a point that says, yeah, it's like, well, they shouldn't be in charge of education or entertainment. How do you do that? Says, well, I don't know, but if you don't prevent them, you're going to have, it's something like you're go to Monticello and it's going to be an anti-white, because David Rubenstein become the oligarch who paid to renovate Monticello. Now it's one big white guilt trip about slavery.
Yeah, it's like this totally, you know, woke 1619 project type nonsense. Yeah.
Yeah. As a nation, should we tolerate that? No. Okay, then let's have that conversation. How do we deal with that? You shall not do this. I don't care how much money you have. You shall not do this. And how'd you get your money?
Right, exactly.
So, well, John, I think we're coming up close to 2 hours now, so
Yeah, thanks, man. I appreciate it. This was a great chat. I knew it would be. It's always great to catch up with you. And you know, you're doing. I've always said that your podcast is definitely one of the top every week. I like listening to. It's one of the best podcasts out there.
Well, thank you.
So do keep up the good work. Oh, excuse me. I said, do keep up the good work. I got something caught in my throat right there at the end. But yeah, no, man, you're doing great work. So yeah, please do keep it up. And people can check out my website at therealistreport.com. One more time, I also write for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper. Their website is americanfreepress.net. And then I also write for the Barnes Review, the really, from what I understand, the last revisionist publication still in existence, certainly in America, maybe even in the world at this point. I'm not sure, but definitely a great magazine worth subscribing to. Their website is barnesreview.org. So I'd encourage people to check out those links.
That's in honor of Harry Elmer Barnes, the historian, right? The anti-war historian?
Correct. Yes. Yep, exactly.
Okay.
Bringing history into accord with the facts.
For some reason, no one knows who he is anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and he was one of the first historians that was poking holes in the official World War I narrative.
That's right.
You know, blaming Germany. And yeah, so he was really a trailblazer. And boy, he was highly demonized for that. You know, definitely going against the grain of the time. And, you know, that's really kind of the whole purpose of the magazine is to carry on that legacy.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, okay. Well, thank you so much. I'll let you go.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, man. Have a good one. Appreciate it.
Good night then. Take it easy.